The material basis and the method for making revolution. What is the material basis for this revolution, the communist revolution? To begin, let's start with a paraphrase of Marx, which has been cited many times and for very good reason. To paraphrase, what is important is not what people are thinking or even what they're doing at any given time, but what they will be compelled to confront by the workings of this system, which is an introduction into, and understood correctly, leads us into grappling with the question of it is of the with you know, grappling with the fact that it is the contradictions of this system and what they give rise to that is the fundamental material basis for this communist revolution. It's not what the thinking of the people is at a given time or how many people are quote-unquote with it at a given time. You know, you go out there and people say, I'm not with that, you know, or people get excited by it and they go out and they talk to people and say, nobody's with that. Well, that's obviously a problem. It's not like that's okay and it's not like it's something that we can leave as it is. Obviously, that needs to be changed and needs to be radically transformed because this revolution has to be made by millions of people who will have contradictory understanding even at the time that they make this revolution. But nevertheless, there has to be a solid core, and it can't be just a few people. It has to be a growing solid core of people, you know, and at the point of a revolution, a solid core of thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are consciously and scientifically approaching the challenge of making revolution, leading broader masses who are being influenced and being led on the basis of that scientific approach to making revolution. So this is a fundamental point. It's important where the masses are at any given time, but that does not set the terms for what we do in fundamental sense, and it is not the fundamental determinant, if you will. It does not tell us whether or not this revolution is possible. The understanding of whether or not this revolution is possible, and that in fact it is possible, resides in a scientific analysis of the contradictions of the system and the dynamics they give rise to continually, and the way in which that's itself continually undergoing transformation, and on which we have to be consciously acting at all times while always being open to new developments and, you know, surprises or accidents. You know, that's the point of those six first paragraphs in part two of Making Revolution and Emancipating Humanity, which I will get into more in another presentation. But for now, let's go back to this point. What is important is not what people are thinking or even what they're doing at any given time, but what they will be compelled to confront by the workings of this system. That it's the contradictions of this system that provide the basis for the revolution that we're working for, and it's by working on those contradictions that we work for that revolution. So let's dig into this a little more. First of all, there's the fundamental contradiction of capitalism, and as we have identified, the principal form of motion of that fundamental contradiction, which we characterize as the driving force of anarchy. In other words, we're dealing with a system here which, overwhelmingly at this point, is dominant in the world. Unfortunately, we don't like that. We hate it. It's even more dominant than it was, you know, three or four decades ago when there was socialist China, you know, or going back for a brief period in the early 50s when there was socialist China and the Soviet Union was still socialist, even though riddled with a lot of its own contradictions. So even then, the imperialist system was still dominant in the world, but it's much more, at this point, it's much more dominant. So you could say, oh, well, you know, things are just going back, you know, they're going away from the revolution we're working toward, you know, that there's less and less basis for it. Well, those are two different statements, and we should pull them apart. One is things have gone away from the revolution we're working for over the past several decades. That's true. The motion in the world has gone away from that for a number of reasons that have been analyzed elsewhere, and I'm not going to try to dig into all that here, or we'd go all over the place and wouldn't be able to focus on the main things we need to focus on. But that's true. Things have gone in a negative direction for several decades. Material changes, political changes, their ideological, you know, expressions, you know, and in terms of how people are seeing the world and how they're being motivated or what their morals are, what they're being drawn toward, for example, religious fundamentalism as opposed to revolutionary communism. you know, what, you know, all that kind of thing has been negative, but that's different than saying there's less and less basis for this revolution. One is looking, if you were to conclude from the first of those two things that the second is the case, if you were to conclude that because things have gone in a negative direction over several decades, that there's less and less basis for revolution, you'd be taking the surface, the more surface, not insignificant, but more surface phenomena. Not insignificant. These are significant phenomena that we have to deal with, confront scientifically, and work to transform. But they're the expression in the present period of how the contradictions are moving and changing. They are not what is most fundamental and what ultimately sets the terms, namely those contradictions themselves and the motion they give rise to. So the fundamental contradiction of capitalism is more and more glaring, more and more acutely posed in the world, not less so. You know, and it takes some rather, you know, perhaps you could say strange or even you might say perverse expressions. One of those expressions is the big attraction now of religious fundamentalism. Christian in some places, including places in Africa, not just in the U.S., for example, but also Islamic fundamentalism in many parts of the world, parts of Asia, Africa, and then obviously the, you know, the Middle East. And so, and not just North Africa, other parts of Africa as well. But, you know, those are real phenomena. But they, in fact, are an expression of the way that the fundamental contradiction of capitalism is actually working itself out at this point, and not in a favorable way, but they are nevertheless a kind of perverse expression of the working, of the carrying forward of that fundamental contradiction. The material conditions that fundamental contradiction, and in particular the driving force of anarchy of capitalism, have brought into being in dialectical relation, in interaction with other things happening, which are in the framework of this overall fundamental contradiction. Political struggles, cultural developments, ideological phenomena, including religion and the promotion of religion by various forces, including the ruling classes of the imperialist states and the U.S. itself. All these things are interacting with the motion of that fundamental contradiction, but it is that fundamental contradiction, and in particular, the driving force of anarchy of capitalism, which is continually bringing forth these dynamics and has brought things to a point where right now they're very unfavorable, actually. But still provides the basis, all this still provides the basis for this to be radically transformed, not just in any old way. Yes, it could be radically transformed in different ways, but there is the basis, and it's not a, you know, sort of, you know, secondary and, you know, unsubstantial or insubstantial basis, but a very, you know, real and very strong basis to actually transform things in the radical direction of communist revolution. So we have to continually go back to that, you know, and otherwise you are, as to use Lenin's phrase, continually whipped around by the chops and petty chops and changes of daily life. And this is what we see happening way too often, not only to people among the masses, broadly, but also among the communists. People are whipped around by the petty chops and changes of daily life. Oh, we went out today and people, you know, it's like Facebook. They have Facebook ideology. You know, we went out today and people gave us a thumbs up. Yay! You know, maybe we can have a revolution in some millennium in the distant future. We went out today and nobody liked what we're doing, and a bunch of assholes, nationalists, or, you know, opportunists, petty bourgeois social democrats, or, you know, counter-revolutionary anarchists attacked our literature table, so I guess there's no basis for revolution. This is, I mean, I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but not that much. This is way too common a way of looking at, rather than looking at the material world, looking at the material world and its actual contradictions, what is the system that is operating in the material world? What is the system, put it this way, through which humanity is being organized and being driven to interact with the rest of nature, and what are all the different things that's giving rise to? This goes back to another fundamental point from Marx, that, you know, in that, I mean, when you say it, it seems so obvious, and yet, you know, Marx had to spend years and years digging through all kinds of political economy and learning from what Darwin was bringing forward in the realm of biology with theory of evolution, and studying political developments and history and philosophy, to sift through all the outward appearances to get to this inner core of the contradiction, as it's been identified by him and by Marxism in general, between the forces of production and the relations of production. That this is the fundamental driving contradiction, which in turn gives rise to, and it's, dialectically interrelated with another contradiction between the mode of production, the economic base, and the superstructure, which arises on the basis of and works to reinforce that economic base. Now, what do these terms mean? They mean that, if you boil it down to its essence, that society, in order for anything to happen in society, the material requirements of life have to be produced and reproduced, and so do new generations of people. And that this is a, when you live in a, as I pointed out before, like, for example, in Birds Cannot Give Birth to Crocodiles, but Humanity Can Soar Beyond the Horizon. And I'll just say Birds and Crocodiles from now on, so I don't have to repeat that title every time. But, I pointed out there, in a highly parasitic country like this one, where you have such a broad swath of people who are not involved indirectly in the production of and reproduction of the material requirements of life. And in fact, this parasitism of U.S. imperialism, with this heightened globalization, has been to transfer more and more of actual productivity to, as they say, outsource it to other countries, particularly third world countries, but generally other countries around the world. And the actual people engaged in production of the material requirements of life has been shrinking relative to the total population. So in a society like that, it's very easy, if you're not part of that small part of the population, a small segment of the population that's actually engaged in directly producing the material requirements of life, it's very easy just to think those things somehow appear or exist. As it's been put by a number of others besides myself, if you're at the end of the food chain, the high end of the food chain, and everybody else is doing all the things that lead up to that, it's very easy not to see all that. Or I like to use the metaphor, you're in a building that's rotting underneath, a foundation is rotting, and as you go down, you're at the top of this building, as you go down the floors, it gets more and more rotting away. But you're at the penthouse at the top, and you actually think this is the way the world is, the way it is in the penthouse. And, all of a sudden, as is sometimes done in those old communist drawings or whatever, there's an eruption from down below. And that's one of the ways you get reminded, oh, there's something else here besides this penthouse I'm residing in. Now, I'm not saying everybody in the U.S. lives in a penthouse. This is a metaphor, and the metaphors like analogies have their limitations. But it's when you're living in a highly parasitic society like this, it's easy not to see, not to perceive, and certainly not to understand in any kind of essential or scientific way, what is the foundation of the society that's functioning that you were pursuing your dreams within. And where does even the wealth come that's in circulation that enables different people to pursue different things? All this is hidden from you. And it's all the more hidden when you're in a highly parasitic society like this. But at the base of all this is the production and reproduction of the material requirements of life and of new generations on that basis. Because new generations can't be reproduced on any other basis either. They can be brought into the world, but if people are even too sickly, they can't even bring children into the world. Or if they do, the infant mortality rate, as we see in much of the third world, is very high. So you have to have even basic material requirements of life in order even to reproduce new generations. And this, the point that Marx brought out, he focused on this. Think of all the ways in which you run into people every day and how they think about, to the degree they ever do think about, what it is that makes the world go round, what it is that it is that actually makes society function, and all the completely erroneous ideas that people have about, or just a lack of any thinking about it even, or some combination of a little bit of thinking and a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding about what it is that, what is it that enables you to get up in the morning and function? Is it your individual, determination, Or is there something that's going on that enables that to happen? That's much bigger than you and is a whole social phenomenon. It involves a whole society and ultimately a whole world of billions and billions and billions of people. We're just getting ready to have the new version of the cosmos. So we have to say billions and billions of people in honor of Carl Sagan and the original cosmos. But anyway, billions and billions of people, to get to the point here, and are all engaged in these activities which are all being, and here's Mark's second point, and the point that's even more, you know, more hidden and crucial, and yet at the same time more hidden and yet very crucial, that in order for this to happen, people have to enter into a certain relations of production which more or less, without being mechanical about it, correspond to the, whatever the productive forces are at hand. And along with this, the fact that the productive forces are continually being developed. People are thinking beings, and in any society they think about new ways to do things, new ways to organize things, and because of the driving force of anarchy, as pointed out in the recent article by Raymond Lotta, capitalism is in fact a very dynamic system, which is driven to continually transform the productive forces, and even some of the relations of production within the overall framework of capitalist production relations. So it's, these things are not static and unchanging, but continuously changing and very dynamic, but always at the cost of great suffering to masses of people in the world, to the great mass of humanity, and ultimately to the detriment of humanity as a whole. And we can see this in the environment, we can see this in the conditions of masses of people, we can see it in the condition of women, we can see it in the oppression of whole nations, we can see it in the wars and on and on, and all the things that are all too familiar to anyone who's paying attention. So this basic understanding is these are the dynamics that Marx brought to light. You know, and I'm always struck, I listen to a lot of these, people in different fields, you know, who are basically pursuing the, you know, bourgeois outlook, you know, even if they're from the petty bourgeoisie, and even if some of them are progressive. And I listen to, even when they have these discussions, or I read articles or books, or where they're grappling with all these questions, including questions about, you know, society, what's wrong with society, is there a way society could be changed, does there have to be so much suffering in the world, on even the people who are trying to take up these from a somewhat better position. And it's just really striking how they're just completely off base. And, you know, just here Marx brought this to light, and they talk about everything and they engage everything but the basic Marxist understanding. It's not just that this is Marxism is a better narrative. It'd be like a bunch of biologists got together and tried to debate about what's happening in the natural world, but they ignored or dismissed Darwin. Biology after Darwin is radically different than biology before Darwin, even though people have continued to develop even what Darwin brought forward. It's continually being developed, as is every field of knowledge where people are approaching it scientifically. But by analogy, the understanding of society, and yes, of philosophy and politics, but the understanding of the fundamental question of why society, you know, functions in the way it does, how it can change, how it does change, how it can undergo radical transformation, what is the fundamental basis for all that? That understanding was synthesized by Marx. And yes, we've gone on and people have contributed, you know, Lenin, Mao, Stalin in some ways, Engels definitely, you know, to this. You know, and I've continued to work on this and bring forward more understanding of it. But Marx made the initial and fundamental breakthrough, and the science of society and the interaction of human beings through society with the rest of nature, and everything that gives rise to, including all the thinking it gives rise to in human beings, that science is as different as before Marx as biology is before Darwin, as compared to after Darwin. And this is, you just listen to people talk, and they talk about everything, but they either ignore or dismiss or distort and dismiss this fundamental understanding. And if you're going to set out to transform the world in a radical direction, to get humanity to a whole different place where all the things that are the daily horrors and assumed to be just a natural order of things, in fact, are transformed and surpassed, then you're going to have to base yourself on a scientific approach to this, rooted in an understanding of the actual contradictions and dynamics that are setting the stage continually and resetting it, and the changes that are constantly occurring, and what changes this makes possible. Not inevitable, but possible, and the fact that different class forces with more or less conscious understanding are going to be continually operating on those, on that same stage, and working on those same contradictions from their own perspective. It's not something that's, you know, like a laboratory. Well, even in a laboratory, if you're dealing with live animals, for example, there's a lot of other things going on. But it's not like you're dealing with passive, you know, entities. You know, just a bunch of unchanging things that you move around to make a revolution. You're dealing with dynamics that are constantly changing, and on which every other force in society, or at least its conscious representative, is working to try to change them in a direction favorable to how they think the world should be. Now, to be clear, this doesn't matter. This doesn't mean that it's all a matter of one narrative versus another narrative, or one interest versus another interest in some sort of non-materialist sense. There is only one resolution of these, all these contradictions, that's in the fundamental interest of the mass of oppressed humanity, and ultimately of humanity as a whole. But that doesn't mean that other class forces don't see every all the representatives of every class think that what this is Marx's point also in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, that all the representatives of every class think that what they're striving for on behalf of the class they represent is in the general interest of society and humanity. All of them think that. I mean, yes, there's some cynical, you know, narrow opportunists and corrupt officials and so on, but the more, you know, however you want to put it, the more, you know, far-seeing or broad-minded representatives of these different classes, you know, if you want to use that term, the ones who are more sincerely striving for these interests, actually think that these are the general interests of society and humanity. They think this is the best way society could possibly be. There's only one actual program and outlook that is for which that is actually true in this era of human history, and in terms of how the contradictions are posing themselves and where they need to go in order to emancipate the oppressed, the wretched of the earth, the oppressed of the world, and ultimately humanity as a whole, and move beyond the point where the contradictions characteristic of capitalism and how it organizes human beings to interact with the rest of nature and the dynamics bound up with that are surpassed, and we're to a whole different era, both in terms of the material relations and in terms of the thinking of the people. This is what Marx and Engels were emphasizing when they said that the communist revolution involves a most radical rupture with traditional property relations. No wonder then that it involves a most radical rupture with traditional ideas. This has a material basis. It's not just that these are better ideas, or, you know, a more just way that society can be organized in the abstract, or just as a set of ideas. Yes, it is more just. But that has a material foundation, and if we don't root ourselves continually, you know, there's a constant pull of spontaneity to be influenced by the outlook of other classes and their representatives, and to start seeing the world through that prism, through those lenses. So it's a constant struggle to go back to the and to grapple collectively, not just as individuals, yes, as individuals, but above all, collectively, among the ranks of the party and what must be the growing ranks of the party, the growing ranks of the movement for revolution, the broader mass of people, to be continually struggling to go back to and deepen our grasp and our living application of the scientific understanding, which again was first broken through on and brought forward by Marx in a qualitative way, you know, with Engels also, but Marx more than anyone else, which again, to use that analogy and drive it home, makes the understanding of the science of society and its interaction with the rest of nature as fundamentally different from how that was approached before Marx, as it is in the realm of biology, as things are fundamentally different after Darwin than before Darwin. Even though people have continued to work on what Darwin brought forward, and there were many things that Darwin did not understand, or partially understood, or even understood incorrectly, while his fundamental understanding was qualitatively correct and a tremendous breakthrough. The same is true in the realm of what we're doing. there were things that Marx didn't understand, Engels, Lenin, certainly Stalin, even Mao. You know, it's more, I say even Mao because he's more recent. You know, but there are things that we've learned that they didn't understand or didn't understand correctly. That's the nature of being scientific. And but yet there is that initial fundamental qualitative breakthrough with Marx. And this basic understanding, yes, is, as it's being continually grappled with and further developed, and it is all of our responsibility to continue to grapple with it and contribute to developing it. But this understanding in that sense is what we have to continually go back to, be regrounding ourselves and grounding more deeply and applying and carrying out the correct dialectical relation between grounding ourselves in it and applying it, learning from what, you know, the experience of applying it, as well as much broader experience in the world, in different realms, deepening our understanding of it, back again with that deep understanding, and in a forward-moving dialectic, dealing with all the complexity without losing the core, without losing the fundamentals, without losing our grip on the fundamentals, even as we continue to subject the fundamentals to questioning. Because this is a science. This is a matter of being consistently, systematically, thoroughly, and comprehensively scientific. And that's actually what Marxism, what communism is. Doesn't mean it doesn't make mistakes. Doesn't mean people who are trying to do it don't get influenced by, you know, by limitations of their own understanding or the outlook of other classes or their own, you know, their own prejudices and biases as individuals or whatever. But that's true in any realm of science, but the scientific method is what enables you to learn from that as well and to sum that up and to deepen and get your understanding more correct in an ongoing process. So this is very important. We have to be scientific, and we have to specifically apply what is in fact the most comprehensive, systematic, and consistent scientific method and approach, the approach of dialectical materialism and communism. Communism, which is grounded in dialectical materialism, just to be clear. Now, one of the things I want to just touch on here, again, I'm not trying to go into all these points at great depth, but just to touch on them as food for thought in the act, just to emphasize, food for thought in the active sense. I was, I learned recently that you know, someone made a very good observation about the point in the speech, now film, Revolution Nothing Less, where toward the end I read out Basics 4.10, which I'll come back to later, and said, I'm doing this as food for thought. People should grapple with this. And then someone commenting on the fact that people really haven't gone back to and grappled with that, even though they were called upon to do so in the speech, including many of our own people in and around the party, said, well, you know, it was said that this was food for thought, but that doesn't mean it was supposed to stay in the refrigerator for a year. So, you know, there is a question of, you know, of food for thought, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do here. But also, that means things to be actively dug into, you know, as well as being ruminated about in an ongoing way, but actively dug into and grappled with individually and collectively in the appropriate forms. But in line with that, I think one of the questions that also needs to be pinpointed and people need to be grappling with, and that gets raised not always in this direct form, or in fact most often not in this direct form, but it gets raised indirectly or in partial ways. What is the question, what is the relation between these other contradictions? For example, the oppression of women or the oppression of nations, oppressed peoples, you know, or the, you know, mental manual contradiction or the relation with the environment. What is the relation between those contradictions and the fundamental contradiction of capitalism and its driving force of anarchy? Now, there are two ways you could go wrong on this. One would be to be very mechanical, to be mechanical materialist instead of dialectical materialist. In other words, to see things in flat and linear terms rather than terms of contradictions, and the motion of different contradictions and the interaction of different contradictions. So you could be mechanical in that way, not seeing that those contradictions and their motion and their interaction, and try to, you know, reduce everything in a vulgar way to, like, everything is the equivalent in a reductionist sense to the fundamental contradiction of capitalism. you know, which would lead you to all kinds of reformism, economism. The oppression of women, in a linear sense, in a reductionist sense, that's just reducible to the exploitation of the proletariat, you know, and the anarchy, you know, the anarchy and the competition anarchy gives rise to between different capitalists. The woman question should be reduced to just how it fits narrowly within that. No, this is a contradiction, the contradiction revolving around the oppression of women. And at the root of the oppression of women existed before capitalism. Existed before they were the great feudal societies of Europe, for example. Existed, you know, at the beginning of the division of society into masters and slaves, and exploiters and exploited. And it has been transformed, taken different forms, been obviously influenced by the mode of production as that's changed throughout history. But it's also retained certain features and certain basic elements that are not reducible to any particular mode of production. This is very important to understand. And yet, how does that mean that this has got nothing to do with the fundamental... See, that would be the other error on the other side, to be undialectical. Well, you know, and by that I mean you look at everything as in little, you know, containers. You know, boxes or containers, each separated from the other. And you have to approach each of these contradictions as self-contained things, not as things which have their own identity, relatively, have relative discreteness and identity and motion and development as such, but as things that are completely walled off from other contradictions. Now let's take once again the oppression of women. The oppression of women, as I just emphasized, predates capitalism. It wasn't brought into being by the capitalist mode of production. It was in many ways transformed, but certainly not eliminated by the capitalist mode of production becoming predominant in many societies and then in the world overall. But is it unrelated to the fundamental contradiction of capitalism? No, because this contradiction, as I just spoke to, is in fact influenced, changed in some significant ways by the changes that have been brought about in different modes of production, including capitalism, and the changes that have taken place within capitalist society, primarily owing to the motion of this fundamental contradiction and the driving force of anarchy. And along with that, the way in which this contradiction finds expression now, the contradiction around the oppression of women, and this, all the social relations bound up with that, and all the ideas bound up with that, are now taking place, even while they have their own discreteness, relative identity, and dynamics as contradictions, as a contradiction in its own right, even while it has all that. It's taking place within a larger framework and context, which is being fundamentally determined by the motion of the fundamental contradiction of capitalism and its driving force of anarchy. And that's the way to understand this. These things have particularity, but they also exist within a larger framework. And it's important to understand both parts of that and to get the relation between that. And again, it's not a static relation. It's a moving and changing relationship, but to get the relations correctly. And the same is true of national oppression. The same is true of something like the environment. Capitalism has its own particular ways of dealing with the environment, but everything, you know, all the changes in the environment are not owing in a direct, linear, and reductionist sense to just the dynamics of the capitalist mode of production. But they are, again, within that framework. So this is the way we have to understand the and they're significantly influenced and even not only affected in some abstract sense but transformed in various ways by those fundamental dynamics of the fundamental contradiction of capitalism and its driving force of anarchy. So that's the way to understand these things and to approach them, and that enables you to see why we have to go to work on particular contradictions. At the same time, we have to understand how they fit into the overall framework of everything that needs to be transformed, and what are the fundamental dynamics that have to be confronted and transformed in order to actually move beyond this whole era and actually get to where, you know, humanity is soaring beyond the whole narrow, yes, what is a very narrow horizon, both in material world and in people's thinking about, you know, the way the world is and the way it could be. So that's, again, food for thought in an active sense, not to be put in the refrigerator and allowed to spoil and never, like Mao says, in order to change the world, you have to actively engage it. In order to taste the pear, you have to bite the pear and change it by biting it. So these are things you have to dig into. And, you know, these something like Basics 410 is very important, but, you know, it's concentrating a lot of things, but like every element of scientific theory, it also needs to be grappled with, it needs to be applied, and yes, it needs to be enriched. That's what all this is about, as opposed to any kind of religiosity, any kind of dogmatism, any kind of narrow reformism, any kind of the underpinnings of all those things, namely the non-materialist and undialectical way of just proceeding from a set of ideas or narratives and looking at things as all, you know, static, unchanging, and separated by walls, you know, impenetrable walls from each other. So all of this emphasizes what we do need to be basing ourselves on and what the living process of a party and the people around it should be all about. It should be, you know, look, it should be full of a lot of fun, including the fun of grappling with theory and lying and being scientific, by the way, which is a lot of fun. Also very frustrating, but a lot of fun, even with all the frustration. But it should have other elements of fun, too, you know, that are not just, you know, directly political or even, you know, certainly not just directly programmatic or whatever. But there should be this continual and ongoing process, a living process, both formally and informally, you know, with the right spirit, with the, you know, through the appropriate means. You know, as someone, you know, has pointed out, it's very important to, in fact, not only is it very important, but it's an essential element of this whole thing to be, for all of us to be critical thinkers about everything. But there's a difference between that and just being petty. You know, people who are, you know, constantly trying to pick apart everything, which is wrong not just because it's petty, but because it's unscientific. And I'll come back to that more. What does it mean, and why is it important to have epistemological discipline? And what does that mean? How does that relate to ranging broadly and grappling and actively with food for thought and the kind of percolation in and around the party on every level and up and down and all around that we need to be constantly having? And again, I say, if you're really, you know, grounding yourself in the scientific approach to this and that kind of method, and the spirit, if I can use that term, that is the accompaniment of and flows from that kind of scientific method and approach, then it's, you know, it's a living process, and it's fun in that sense, even while it's often frustrating. But, you know, the point ultimately is neither to be fun, to have fun, nor to be frustrated, is to change the world. But on the other hand, the process itself is consistent with where we're trying to go, and needs to be consistent with it. Both in the spirit of it, if you will, and in most fundamentally in the method and approach of it. And this is something that really has to be, there's much more transformation that needs to go on. Not by turning inward and having a lot of just, you know, internal grappling among, you know, the small, way too small at this point, ranks of the revolution and the party, but by going out to the world and in that context having that kind of living grappling with people broadly in society, but also right within our own ranks in the process of doing that. And all of this is posed objectively, not in terms of, once again, of one set of ideas versus another, or one narrative versus another, but objectively, and in terms of fundamental method and approach and orientation, is posed up against, on the one hand, reification and spontaneity, and on the other hand, determinism. Now, by reification and spontaneity, what I'm getting at is goes back to what I started out with. That, you know, for example, there was a statement that came forward in the Cultural Revolution, which some of us, when we were coming forward, were influenced by, and it's wrong. It was a slogan that was popularized for a while in the Cultural Revolution. It was wrong, and it actually did some harm. And to our, you know, we've got to look back on and think about it and sum it up scientifically to the degree we haven't already. And that was this statement, which was brought forward in the midst of what was a very positive development, the Cultural Revolution, involving tens and ultimately hundreds of millions of people grappling with these same kinds of questions we're grappling with here, as well as the how they apply to all different realms of society and policy and program and so on. But the slogan or the saying was, the mainstream of the mass movement is always correct. No. You know, and you know, at that time, the mainstream of that mass movement was correct. But that just happened to be, you know, the convergence of some very good leadership with masses who were, you know, going in the direction of that leadership and thrashing through things with that leadership in a good way. But as a general principle, that's completely wrong. Think about its application. You know, there have been many mass movements, fascist mass movements, you know, social democratic reformist movements that are totally within the confines of capitalism, reactionary nationalist movements as opposed to more revolutionary nationalists. Plenty of movements which are not correct. And they're not necessarily, you know, like not every struggle for reform. I'm not saying every struggle for reform is negative. But reformism as a worldview and an approach, a program, is very negative. You know, when it's raised to the level of a principle, this working for reform within this system is all that we can possibly do and should try to do. That's very negative when it's raised to that level of a line or a principle, or if you want to put it that way. But there have been all kinds of mass movements. And, you know, and you still see this, you know, and you know, the idea of circulating around, having influence amongst better people today, people who consider themselves progressive or liberal or even some consider themselves radical. Or whatever, where, you know, you see the, you know, like another slogan that came out, mainly I think this slogan was, at least it was certainly taken up, if it wasn't initiated, it was certainly taken up by a lot of revisionist forces. The people united will never be defeated. Well, unscientific. First of all, people have been united and defeated many times, especially where they haven't had correct leadership, but even sometimes where they haven't, but the balance of forces was against them in the short term, which doesn't mean that the leadership, that is not, if you lose, that doesn't mean you're incorrect. But sometimes you can be correct and lose, and sometimes you lose because you're incorrect. But first of all, people have been united, quote unquote, and defeated many times, sometimes because they're united around the wrong thing, and sometimes because the other forces they're up against are more powerful at the given time. But second of all, if, you know, who's this people? You know, among the people, there are different classes. You know, when without being reductionist and narrow mechanical, you know, about classes and being, therefore, actually economist, workerist, you know, there are, in broad terms, different classes among the people, and there are representatives who, however consciously they perceive this, are actually objectively acting as the, as Marx put it, the political and literary representatives of these different classes. And they're all contending. Again, going back to what I said earlier, all of them, let's give people the best, the benefit of the doubt, you know, or the best interpretation, all proceeding from how they, through the prism of the class outlook they've taken up, perceive to what are the general interests of the people or society or humanity. But they're not all being scientific. They're not all scientifically approaching what are the actual interests of the masses of people. And what are the contradictions that have to be struggled through to actually realize the interests of the broad masses of people and ultimately humanity. So the people contains a lot of different contending forces. And yes, you know, it's not wrong in many cases for those people to be broadly united around things. Often that's very correct and very important, but that doesn't negate the fact that within that broad unity, there are different and contending forces representing different and contending programs, or to put it, you know, simply trying to take people and society to a different place, different places, within the context of what already exists, or trying to go to something different. But then the question, what something different are they trying to go to if it's radically different? And there are political and literary representatives who emerge who, in broad strokes and without being, you know, mechanical about this and ridiculous, you know, do actually strive for the interests of these different social or class forces in society. That's, the people consists of all that. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. If there's one class and one force, again, not being narrow and mechanical and economist, but speaking broadly, if there's one class whose political and literary representatives will fold up their tent and not fight for the interests of that class, broadly speaking, within the current situation, it is the proletariat and its political and literary representatives. Because that's the one class that not only doesn't have, and its representatives, that not only doesn't have spontaneity going for it, but has to go up against a tremendous amount of spontaneity of the existing system and all the relations and ideas and cultures and values and institutions and on that reflect and reinforce that system. So it's a constant struggle of the communists against spontaneity, which means also against tailing the masses. Because, again, if you understand this scientifically and not mechanically, it is not the case that each social group or class spontaneously acts in accordance with its own interests. And once again, in particular, the one class in this, you know, under the rule of capital that doesn't most of the time act in its own interests is the proletariat. The petty bourgeoisie, let me put it another way. The petty bourgeoisie can, to a very, and its various segments and strata, because it's not one uniform thing, but all these different petty bourgeois strata making up, broadly speaking, the middle class, the petite bourgeoisie, if you will, they more or less spontaneously do act in their interests. Because, you know, they don't have to make any radical ruptures in their thinking or with the existing society in order to act in their interests. I mean, yes, it's true that the interests of the petty bourgeoisie are constantly being undermined and attacked by the dynamics of capitalism and the ruling class of capitalism and its institutions. But as such, the interests of the petty bourgeoisie, even though they're on the one hand being propped up to a certain degree, but on the other hand being undermined and suppressed by the workings of the system, those interests don't require any radical rupture and can't lead to, if somebody acts in the most conscious way on the interests, in terms of representing the interests of the petty bourgeoisie, they cannot lead to any radical rupture. So they can have a lot of spontaneity going for them, the spontaneity of the existing system, and obviously the bourgeoisie, we don't have to talk about that. They obviously have the system going for them, even though the system causes them all kinds of problems. Why? Because the system is characterized by this fundamental contradiction in its dynamics, and in particular the driving force of anarchy, and it is riddled by all these other contradictions that either arise from or are encompassed now within the dynamics of the fundamental contradiction of capitalism, the driving force of anarchy, and all that this gives rise to go back to the early discussion about understanding the relation between other contradictions and the fundamental contradiction. But the political and literary representatives of the proletariat have to go up against overwhelmingly have to go up against the spontaneity of the very class and masses of people, the wretched of the earth, the oppressed of the earth, whose interests they fundamentally represent. And because those masses are caught within the web and the dynamics, if you will, the living, moving web and the dynamics of the capitalist system, and all the influence of those social relations and the superstructure, the culture, the ideology, the political institutions of that system. That's why, you know, Marx brought forward the four alls. You know, not just as an idea, again, but as a scientific concentration of what you have to get beyond in order to really make those two radical ruptures and get to a whole different world without exploitation and oppression and antagonistic divisions and antagonistic relations among people and all the violent destruction that arises and is bound up with that, rises from and is bound up with that. You know, he's talked about you have to get beyond all the economic relations, the production relations, all the social relations that either arise from or are encompassed within those dynamics. You know, you have to get beyond the ideas that stem from those. You have to get beyond the class relations that are rooted in those economic relations, the social relations that are bound up with that, and the ideas that go along with and reinforce all that. This is the whole problem. And there's no class in this society and no section of the people that's going to spontaneously come up with that and consciously go for that. They are, in fact, even those people who have the most fundamental interest in this, are going to be constantly pulled by spontaneity, and by that I mean also the workings of the system and how that affects their spontaneous thinking and actions, are going to be constantly pulled away from that, even though it's in their own interest, and even though they will also gravitate toward it spontaneously. That's the contradictory nature of it. And so this is why any kind of reification, any kind of idea that, you know, the mainstream of the mass movement is always correct, oh, you know, somebody's from an oppressed group, they must know what's right, you know, at least about their own oppression or the oppression of their... No! I'm sorry, this is a matter of science. And it's a matter of what Lenin identified, the constant striving to come under the wing of the bourgeoisie. Why? Why is there a constant striving to come? He, you know, I've pointed this out before, and it's worth stopping on it for a second, you know, going into it again for a little while, even if briefly. Why does he, look, note Lenin's wording. He doesn't just say the constant pull to go under the wing of the bourgeoisie. What word does he use? The constant striving to come under the wing of the bourgeoisie. Because, you know, and you see it over and over again. You know, Mandela, what is Mandela? You know, let's give him his due. Very courageous, willing to sacrifice tremendously, in his own mind, having the interests of the wretched of South Africa, and more broadly in mind, but comes under the wing of the bourgeoisie. And not out of cowardice, but according to his own, you know, what I've heard was his own accounting of this is that he and others, you know, with whom he's aligned, made a calculation that if they didn't go for this arrangement that the imperialists were, you know, had cooked up and were presenting to them, that then there would be this, you know, tremendous rupture in society and a massive amount of violence and people would suffer. Well, constantly you come up against that kind of thing, whether you're a conscious representative of some force or other, ultimately representing some social grouping or class or other, or whether you're just a mass going, you know, one of the masses of people, I should say, going along in the, within this movement. You constantly come up with the price you pay. If you don't come under the wing of the bourgeoisie, as well as the fact that the, as Marx and Engels pointed out, the ruling ideas of every age or every society are ever the ideas of the ruling class. So you're constantly influenced by those ideas, that way of thinking, and the implications politically, the programmatic implications that flow from that. And over and over and over again, both out of opportunist, but even, yes, out of sincere motivation, we see people exerting influence and gaining influence and then using that to compromise with the existing system. Sometimes out of just, you know, the narrowest, most corrupt and venal ambitions of their own, but sometimes, even more painfully, out of a genuine motivation to try to change the world in a way that they think will lessen the suffering of people. But not recognizing, because they're not being thoroughly scientific and their orientation isn't to do that, to approach everything with a scientific method, they don't really get to the fundamental truth that unless you radically transform, rupture with and overthrow and radically transform overthrow the existing system and radically transform the society and ultimately the world in a certain way toward the elimination of those four alls that Marx identified, production relations, class relations, social relations, and ideas, radically transforming those. Unless you do that, you're not going to make the conditions of the masses of humanity better, and in fact, they're going to get worse, even as capitalism will keep on perpetuating itself according to its own dynamics and its dominant position in the world. So, we see this, you know, the history is full of examples of people who led massive struggles involving, you know, heroic self-sacrifice, not only on the part of the, you know, the rank and file, if you will, but the leaders too. And yet, not always out of cowardice, not always out of narrow, venal corruption, but out of a misplaced motivation flowing from a wrong understanding based in an unscientific approach, they actually do what in fact amounts to coming back under the wing of the bourgeoisie, moving things back within the existing system. And look at what the conditions of the massive people in South Africa is today. Massive African people. Yes, apartheid is gone, and it was good. It was just and righteous to struggle to get rid of apartheid. But if that is the made the end point of the struggle, then you see what happens. The massive people are suffering horribly, and what's even worse, they are demoralized because they were suffering horribly under apartheid, but there was a feeling that they needed to rise, you know, a sentiment that they needed to rise up against it. And they did rise up against it, and they sacrificed to get rid of it. But now there's demoralization and confusion because they've gotten rid of it, but they're still suffering terribly under the domination of imperialism and exploiting classes within their own country, ultimately subordinate to imperialism. And you can go through history. This is why at the end of the Cultural Revolution in China, they had the campaign around the classical Chinese novel, The Water Margin. Very few people understood what the hell that was about, but it was actually extremely important. Unfortunately, not very many people were paying enough attention or understood it. You know, it was launched with Mao making these comments about how, I think his name was Sun Jiang, but anyway, the hero of The Water Margin was someone who led all these massive peasant uprisings. And then at a certain point was offered inducements and emoluments. Emoluments, or however you pronounce that word. How do you pronounce that word? Emoluments. Anyway, offered inducements, okay? from the emperor. And probably including a package of reforms. And he accepted it and went back in the ranks of the existing system. Served the emperor. And the slogan that came forward was, people like this are against corrupt officials only, but not against the emperor. And that was a metaphorical way of saying there are lots of people who strive and lead people and sacrifice, put themselves on the line. Mandela goes to jail for decades. But ultimately, they're just against, you know, particularly egregious oppression of the system. Particular outrages or particular ways in which the system makes people suffer, but they don't ultimately go for abolishing the system as a whole, and so the horror goes on. That was the point of that water margin thing. That to be against corrupt officials only and not the emperor didn't mean literally the emperor. It meant the whole system. That was the metaphor. To only, you know, and you see it all the time, occupy whatever, you know, there's too much corporate influence. Well, of course there is, because, you know, corporations are a concentration of capital, and it's a capitalist system. Of course there's going to be. But that's not the essence of the problem. The problem is the very nature of the system in its underlying economic dynamics and in its superstructure to enforce that, including the state with all of its repressive, you know, military, police, courts, prisons, bureaucracies, administrative power, and so on. That's what has to be. And if you don't sweep all that aside and replace it with a system that's operating according to different dynamics, and yes, is characterized by different contradictions, because there's no system without contradiction, including communism. But it's a whole qualitatively different set of contradictions, economically, politically, socially, culturally, ideologically. If you don't get to that, then you're just going to have, in somewhat transformed form, perhaps, or usually, I mean, often in transformed form, the same, you know, horrendous oppression and suffering of the masses of humanity, and maybe even the extinction of humanity through the destructive way it's interacting with the environment and or wars. So, you know, this is a very fundamental lesson, and you will never get the right thing if you are going by reification and tailing spontaneity. If you think just the masses in the street tells you what's right and wrong, I mean, how many times have we seen this? You know, people don't make an attempt to make a scientific analysis of what the content is of what's going on. Whether it's Ukraine now, Venezuela, you know, Jared Leto gets up at the Academy Awards and praises the people in the streets. I'm sorry, Jared, but you don't know fuck all about what's going on there, obviously. You know, I believe your heart's good, you know, but that's not enough. It's, let me put it this way, it's necessary. If you don't care, you know, if you have no passion about the condition of humanity and the fact that it doesn't have to be this way, get out of here, because you're never going to do anything good. you know, or more to the point, develop that passion by understanding what really is going on in the world and paying attention and caring. But that's not going to take you where you need to go. It's a foundation. It's part of the foundation you need. It's essential, but it's not enough. You have to go to be scientific. When people are in the street, well, what are they doing? Under what banner are they being mobilized? What is the objective content and objective effect of what they're doing, and what is the subjective consciousness with which they're doing it? And what is the correct understanding of the synthesis of those things? Sometimes people's, what they're doing objectively can be very good, and their subjective consciousness is not so good. And you have to determine what's principle in that contradiction. That's a contradiction. What's principle? What's mainly defining what's out in the street? L.A. Rebellion in 92, could you find lots of wrong subjective thinking? Yes. But objectively, was it mainly and overwhelmingly positive? Yes. There are times when the reverse is true. People are out with good intentions, but what they're objectively doing is bad, leading in a wrong direction, harmful. You have to be a living scientist, and if you're talking about leading a revolution, forget it if you're not being, consistently. I'm not saying you don't make mistakes or you don't, have limitations. We all have limitations. That's the nature of being human beings interacting with the rest of the world. This is not some humanist thing about we're all just flawed human beings. I'm saying human beings have limitations in what they can understand and how they can act at a given time, even when they're really trying to be scientific. But we've got to consistently put ourselves individually, but above all collectively, to grappling with how to be scientific, what it means in general and also in its particular application to many contradictions at any given time. And increasingly deepening our grounding in that and our ability to get better and better at doing it, even while we're going to always, have shortcomings. So if you're going by reification and spontaneity, look, and if you're thinking about, here's the point where it comes together, if you're really thinking about the masses of people and you're being scientific, I don't give a flying fuck what some fucking opportunist jumps up and says. I mean, I care if it has an effect, but I'm not going to let that influence how I'm going to approach that. And I'm not, this is not some individual proclamation on my part. I'm saying as a point of orientation, we shouldn't give a flying fuck in terms of allowing ourselves to be intimidated or influenced by what a bunch of opportunists, I don't care in what garb they come. And I don't care how many quote-unquote credentials they try to drape themselves in. If you have to ask yourself, now if what they're putting forward, does it better represent the interests of where humanity needs to go than what we're doing? If so, then let's take it up and learn from it. If not, then we're not going to tail after it and we're not going to be intimidated by it. We're going to struggle with it. And we're going to put ourselves on the line to struggle with it. Because it matters, because you have to keep the fundamental questions of two things. For whom and for what? That's either two things or one. But anyway, for whom and for what? And being scientific about determining what is actually the interest of whom. And if we don't approach it that way, we're just going to be whipped around, by all kinds of opportunists and by the petty chops and changes of daily life, or even big changes in society, like Lenin pointed out in the collapse of the Second International. Every major turn in the world, like an eruption of a world war in that case, tempers and strengthens some people and breaks others. So, you can't be whipped around by the petty chops and changes of daily life. You can't also be thrown off your bearings by big monumental changes that happen perhaps without much warning, or at least in ways that you didn't anticipate. And if the only way to do that is to continually be grounded in this scientific method and approach, and the most consistent, systematic, and comprehensive and thorough scientific approach, communism, based in its dialectical materialism. And this also, on the one hand, not only leads you to be able to understand the need and the basis for combating spontaneity and for not falling into reifying different sections of the people or different people who come forward sincerely or otherwise as representatives of different sections of the people. It enables you to actually analyze what these people are or movements or trends represent and what they have to do or positively or negatively with where things need to go in terms of a radical transformation of the whole world through revolution with the final goal of communism. But it also enables you, on the other side of it, if you will, to not fall into determinism. Because being scientific enables you to understand that the whole world is made up of contradiction. And that the society, human society and its interaction with the rest of nature is characterized by certain fundamental and decisive contradictions. Namely that between the forces and relations of production and between the relations of production or the economic base or the mode of production on the one hand and the superstructure of politics and ideology and culture on the other hand. And that takes different form in different systems. You know, capitalism, again, has its own particular, ways in which those basic contradictions are expressed. In the fundamental contradiction of capitalism and its driving force of anarchy, and in all the other contradictions that arise out of that or are encompassed within it, such as, again, with the latter example of encompassed within it, the oppression of women, as one very important example. So if you're actually proceeding on that basis, then you're not just looking at what you're confronted with. You're not just looking at necessity, whether you identify it as necessity or not. You're not just looking at difficulty. You're not just looking at backwardness among the masses. You're not just looking at the power that the ruling class and its system still does have, yes. But you're looking more deeply and in a more living way at all the dynamics within that, all the contradictory dynamics within that, going right down to the fundamental contradiction and everything, again, that arises from or is encompassed within that, and the pathways that can be hacked out, if you will, can be forged through struggle on the basis of those contradictions. Not ones that are handed to you, but the pathways that are potentially there that you have to then struggle to break open and to lead people on and to keep leading people on because, again, the spontaneous pull to come, this spontaneous striving to come under the wing of the bourgeoisie. If you're not aware of that as you're going forward, you forge out a path, you're marching ahead, and you look around, everybody's going off. And you're standing there by yourself because you haven't paid attention to the fact that the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie and their political and literary representatives are also working on these contradictions and working on the forces you're trying to lead on the basis of these contradictions, that you need to lead on the basis of these contradictions. So, there's necessity, but necessity is contradiction. Necessity is not just, oh, shit. Necessity is not just problem. It is. It's not just difficulty. It's not just obstacle. Necessity is contradiction. And if you understand it that way, then you don't fall into determinism. And if you have the right synthesis, then you can see how, on the one hand, reification, spontaneity, tailing the masses, just looking at the motion without the content of it when people are moving, actually, is mutually reinforced by determinism. Those form a kind of perverse synthesis themselves. If communists or others seeking to change the world don't have a scientific approach, they will find themselves both falling into tailing spontaneity and reification and bowing down to necessity in a determinist way. And it's the orientation of for whom and for what. Here's what I say to these fucking opportunists of various kinds and to the representatives of the bourgeoisie. I'm sorry, but there's just one problem. If I bow down to you, the masses of people are going to be fucked again and fucked on and on and on. And that's why I cannot bow down to you. Not because I'm better than you are, not because I'm smarter than you are, not because, in some essence of mine, I'm a better person than you are, or whatever, but because of that very fact, which science tells me and keeps me deepening my understanding of, that if I bow down to this, then the masses of people are going to remain chained within this horrific conditions, enslaved and oppressed and exploited in horrific ways. Maybe some new ways, but horrific ways always. And that's why we cannot do it. And that's why we have to fight against all that for something radically different. And that's why we have to be scientific in order to actually fight in the way that we need to fight for that. So that's sort of the first overarching point I want to speak to within this, you know, general subject, if you will, of the material basis and the method for making revolution. To put it another way, that's sort of, all of that is sort of to what's the material basis for revolution. I've started to talk about method, and then I want to turn more directly to the question of a scientific method and approach.